Infernomatic Productions.
Are you ready?
Live from the Metal Mayhem Studios in Rochester, New York.
We are gold.
And heard around the world by metalheads just like you. This is Metal Mayhem ROC.
Heavy metal music.
Your weekly dose of metal music, interviews, album reviews, news, and more.
Want to be part of the show?
Send us a message through our website,
MetalMayhemROC.com.
Or hit us up on Facebook and Twitter.
Search Metal Mayhem ROC.
It's getting nice and heavy.
And now, welcome tonight's host, John the Vernomatic Verno.
Good evening, everybody. Hope everyone's doing well. Usually new content drops on Thursday nights, but tonight we got a special one. We're observing the death date of the late, great Bon Scott. 43 years ago tonight, February 19th, 1980, Bon was found passed out and dead in a car in London. And at the time, everyone thought it was an alcohol poisoning death. Well, we got author Jesse Fink on the show tonight. Jesse has written two AC/DC biographies. The first one is The Youngs, the brothers who built AC/DC. And then he came back with an even bigger, better, and more controversial book called Bon, The Last Highway. Now, this book, Bon, The Last Highway, Fink concludes that Scott died of a heroin overdose and not the official cause, alcohol poisoning. Real interesting. He also addresses and provides new information regarding the widespread speculation that Scott contributed uncredited lyrics to the AC/DC album Back in Black. You know, it was always fishy in my eyes how a band could lose a singer, get a new one, regroup, record a new album, and release it within 150 days. Well, we're going to have Jesse here in a minute, and we're going to go over that plus much, much more. But first, just want to remind you to get up to that Metal Mayhem ROC website, metalmayhemroc.com. Sign up for our email newsletter. It's our way of staying in touch with you on new shows, contests that we run, promos for our radio show on Monday night. Staff reviewer Mark Zagatti's there with CD reviews. Lately, last couple shows, last week, we had Robin McCauley and Graham Bonnet talking about their solo albums and their tours and MSG anecdotes. A couple weeks ago, we had John Gallagher of Raven, and we had the engineer from the Metallica Kill 'Em All album here. We were playing some outtakes from the Kill 'Em All sessions that no one's ever heard. That was a good one. And Steve Rosen, the author of the new Eddie Van Halen book, Tone Chaser, started things off in the mid-January for this year. So again, get up to the website, download some of these past shows, rate, review, subscribe, and that kind of stuff really does help. Okay, well, let's get into this. Jesse Fink and the book Bon, The Last Highway. Going to run a spot for this year's Rockin' Pod going on in Nashville in early March, and then we'll get the Jesse Fink on here for this Bon Scott special. Okay, everyone, thank you for your support, and as always, keep it heavy.
For those who love it loud, Pantheon Podcast presents Rockin' Pod Weekend, Nashville, March 17th through the 19th. It's a rock convention featuring panels, interviews, podcasts, signing sessions, vinyl, comic books, pop culture, and collectibles. Over 50 celebrity guests, including members of Mr. Big, Tough, Great White, Keel, Winger, Accept, and Twisted Sister. Live concerts including Rare Hair on Friday, Keel Fest 2 on Saturday, and Eric Martin's Big Acoustic on Sunday. Plus a rockin' comedy show featuring Courtney Cronin-Dold, Don Jameson from That Metal Show, and Craig Gass from The Howard Stern Show, and a whole lot more. Full details at rockinpod.com. Rockin' Pod Weekend is presented by Pantheon Podcasts in association with RFK Media, Third Power Amplification, and BobbyDreyer.com.
Tonight's guest is Jesse Fink. Jesse is a British-Australian author of five books. 2007 had the Socceroos, the 2006 FIFA World Cup story, 2012 a memoir of divorce and dating, And in 2020, his fifth book, Pure Narco, The Life Story of Cocaine Trafficker Luis Navia. Sounds interesting. In between there, he had the twin biographies of the hard rocking band AC/DC. Jesse, welcome to Metal Mayhem. How are you, my friend?
Great to be here, mate, and good to be talking to you.
I think we broke a record tonight. I'm in upstate New York, and you are in Bali, I believe?
Bali, Indonesia, yep.
On the other side of the world.
The technology joins us. So this coming Sunday is going to be the 43-year anniversary of the passing of the late, great Bon Scott. And you got involved with not one, but two biographies surrounding the band AC/DC. You know, you're a nonfiction author, and like I stated in the open, you've had five books, and the new one's coming out in 2023. How did you get involved with AC/DC? And not once, but twice.
My second book was a book about my divorce from my first wife. And you know, I don't know if any of your listeners have ever been through a divorce, but it's a fairly kind of traumatic experience, particularly when children are involved. So, you know, mentally and emotionally, I was struggling through that whole sort of period. And it sort of coincided too with the end of my sports writing career. I was writing for a TV network here in Australia. I sort of got involved in an ethical dispute with one of the heads of the network. You know, I felt that what they were doing was wrong, and I sort of stood up to them and sort of lost my career as a result. So professionally, my life was in the toilet. Personally, my life was in the toilet, and I was quite suicidal, actually. And, you know, feeling completely sort of lost and down and like my life had sort of ended. And there was a night where I was sort of sorting black socks on the end of my bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, thinking my life can't get any fucking worse than this. And, you know, I heard a garbage truck outside, and I thought, you know, it would just be very easy to just go and walk in front of that garbage truck and just sort of end my life. And for some reason, instead of doing that, I had a laptop on the end of my bed, and it just happened to be on Powerage, and I put on some Powerage, and it was Give Me a Bullet, and you know, it was just like this fucking wall of sound, you know, the Young's guitars on that track, and it sort of just lifted me up, and I just was completely energized by it, and I really kind of felt like the next day that sort of AC/DC had intervened at the right time and sort of saved my life. And so I felt like this duty almost to write a book to say thank you to them. And so that's how the Youngs sort of started as a project, because I actually contacted my publisher pretty much the next day and said, you know, hey, has anyone ever done a book on Angus and Malcolm Young? And she said, oh, well, why don't you add George Young as well? And so suddenly we had a book. And so that was literally how it sort of came about. It was just sort of came out of this sort of personal sort of moment of anguish. And I wanted to write a book about how sort of AC/DC's music emotionally connected with people around the world, and why is it that this band is the biggest rock band in the world when so many other very good rock bands just don't have the same connection. So that was the idea. And that book went on and became, you know, very successful. It was published in about 20 countries and 13 languages and whatever. And then out of that, obviously, because that was successful, Penguin was very interested in another book. And of course, I thought Bon Scott immediately.
Well, first and foremost, I'm sorry for the troubles you went through, and thank God there was a, quote, higher power that, you know, kept you with us. I have gone through a divorce, and I've never fallen to where you were, but it is a tough time, so I'm glad things did work out for you, friend. That's scary stuff.
It is scary stuff, but, you know, then it leads you on to other things. And so, you know, it got me to write this book. It got me to write the book on Bon Scott. And if I hadn't written the book on Bon Scott, I wouldn't have written the book about cocaine trafficking. And now I'm writing about spies in World War II. So that's how life works out.
Before we get into the Bond book, I have my notes and comments on that. It's fantastic. What really amazed you about George Young and the dynamics of Malcolm and Angus? Because George was older. Give us a quick little summary of the meat and the potatoes of that book, if you can.
Well, the book wasn't a traditional biography. It was sort of set up as sort of 11 chapters about 11 different songs that I felt were really important in the history of AC/DC. And, you know, the first chapter is about Good Times by the Easy Beats, which was a song that was covered on the Lost Boys soundtrack by INXS and Jimmy Barnes. And so Americans might know it best from that film. And the second chapter was about a song called Evie by Stevie Wright, who was the lead singer of the Easy Beats. And after Bond died, Stevie was briefly considered as a possible replacement, but he was sort of lost in his heroin addiction, so that was never going to happen. But musically, those songs are very, very connected to the story of AC/DC. And so the rest of the chapters in that book are about AC/DC songs. But if you look at the sonic architecture of AC/DC, you'll find it has its roots in the Easy Beats and what, you know, George Young was doing with the Easy Beats in the late 60s. And then he brought that into, you know, his production work and so by the time, you know, he started working on, you know, AC/DC's first album as producer, you know, he had basically perfected what we now know as the AC/DC sound. So the whole book really is kind of a homage to that sound. You know, I mean, how would you describe that sound? I think it's a very distinctive Australian sort of rock sound that, you know, people around the world try to replicate, but they don't sort of manage to do very successfully. And for some reason, Australian rock bands seem to do it very well. And I know that, you know, Guns N' Roses was very influenced by Australian rock. You know, but were it not for Rose Tattoo, would we have Guns N' Roses today? Probably not.
I didn't realize that. I've been an AC/DC fan for years. I didn't realize that. Rose Tattoo was around before AC/DC?
Rose Tattoo were another Albert's act. I would tell your listeners to go out and listen to, while we're talking about Australian rock and Guns N' Roses, go and dig out a song called Unpublished Critics by Australian Crawl and then play Sweet Child of Mine. They're almost identical. So
I'll do my heavy metal homework and check that out.
Check it out. But yeah, no, Guns N' Roses was very influenced by Rose Tattoo, obviously. Rose Tattoo is another amazing sort of Australian rock band that never really got their dues like so many Australian rock fans did. So, you know, The Youngs was also about Australian rock music and why I think it's really special and why Australia had this amazing vein of rock in the late 70s and early 80s. And I wanted to sort of bring that to the world as much as I could. And you know, I was very happy that the book got published where it did. You know, it ended up in places like, you know, Japan and Argentina. You know, so that's great for me as an author.
You weren't an AC/DC fan before the awakening, if you will?
Oh, I knew of them, obviously, but, you know, I was not a devotee by any means. If I had to sort of, you know, tell you what my sort of favorite music is, it would be very different to AC/DC. It's sort of like Steely Dan, Doobie Brothers, you know, even Bee Gees, you know, sort of smooth AOR, sort of West Coast rock. Now, that's really kind of what I listen to most. But, you know, somehow in between all that, I've managed to kind of find a place in my life for AC/DC. And, of course, you know, when you spend next to, almost 10 years on two AC/DC books, you get quite obsessive about it. You end up sort of, you know, knowing a lot and sort of, you know, I've started a Bon Scott forum on Facebook. We've got 16,000 members. We talk about, you know, anything you can imagine, sort of 24 hours a day. So people are quite obsessed about AC/DC.
So you did the Young Brothers. It gets popular. Now you get commissioned to do the Bon Scott book. Hundreds of interviews, the attention to detail. You're telling a story. Quickly explain how you did all this, because it's fascinating.
Well, I mean, obviously it was a very different book to the Youngs in that it was a, you know, sort of a linear biography. It was a story. It was a narrative. And my focus was the years 1977 to 1979, which essentially took Bon from his first concert in Texas right through to Ohio at the end of 79. And so the book, when I first started, was really just going to be about, you know, Bon's time in America, which is the last highway, you know, the road that he took to his death. Because that's where AC/DC did all their touring.
Yep.
In the years, you know, certainly, you know, 80% of their touring was taking place in the United States because they were trying to make it there. And then when I got to the end of, you know, that work of documenting Bon's time in America, I realized I couldn't really ignore the death. Now, the death had sort of been covered to some degree in a previous book about Bon Scott by Clinton Walker, a book called Highway to Hell.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, before I'd gone into this project, I liked that book. It was a book that I enjoyed reading. But then after I had done my own investigation of Bond's death, I just felt it was completely deficient. So I felt like there were so many things in that story that just hadn't been covered by Clinton Walker. So I ended up spending, I think, a year and a half alone just on the last 24 hours of Bond's life, because it was such a murky tale. And so in the end, the whole book ended up sort of taking 4 years of writing and research. And so it really sort of took over my life and became a sort of like an obsessive quest, almost like a, you know, sort of Heart of Darkness style obsession, really. And I felt like at the end of it that I had sort of come to grips with who he was as a human being rather than the caricature, you know, the rock legend that, you know, people like to talk about, you know, the guy who, you know, shags two women a day, who, you know, drinks a bottle of whiskey and gets up sort of bright and perky and will get up on stage and deliver the greatest show ever, and, you know, is cracking jokes and, you know, everyone's best friend and, you know, all this sort of bullshit. But in fact, you know, Bon had a fairly dark story behind, you know, the veneer. And so it was my kind of attempt, I think, to really get to know someone that I was deeply interested in myself, but I didn't feel like the existing accounts of his life actually really worthy, really, of you know, being portrayals of this person.
Sure, many times there's tears behind those smiles. Now, when you say you're obsessed with it, how were you doing research? Were you hitting the pavement, retracing the steps? going to bars that bartenders served them beers, and almost like a private investigator.
Yeah, there was definitely a private investigation element to it. Yeah, and I would certainly, you know, I was in America for some of that, and so, you know, I was in New York. I would meet, you know, people who were connected to ACDC who were still in New York, and, you know, go to places, yeah, literally on foot where, you know, ACDC might have been. I went down to Miami to meet his girlfriend down there. Mm-hmm. He still lived in Miami. I sort of ended up spending a hell of a lot of time on Facebook, just sort of finding, you know, the lead singer or the lead guitarist or the bass player from, you know, this obscure 1970s band who happened to, you know, be the support act for AC/DC that night in, you know, Bumbaco, Ohio.
Who's the band that, from Florida?
Critical Mass.
And listeners, this is fantastic. If you haven't read or listened to the book, this local band or regional band, Bon happens to walk into the bar after an AC/DC show and the band was playing, and they end up drinking that night and they become instant friends. Bon is bringing the guy back to the hotel because his buddies took off. Something close to that, right, Jesse? That's close to how the story.
Holly X, the girl down in Miami, was basically mentioned to me by this guy called Michael Fazzolari, who was this very funny guy who sells refrigerators in Orlando, actually. But in 1979, he was sort of fronting this incredibly hot sort of rock group called Critical Mass, who had a deal with MCA Records. And so there was like this healthy rock scene in Miami at that time. You know, there was a, you know, very young Johnny Depp, you know, was part of that. He was about 15 years old and he was in a band called The Kids. So there were all these sort of bands playing around, you know, Miami, Hollywood Beach, and Michael introduced me to Holly. And my connection to Michael was a DJ called Neil Mirsky. And Neil Mirsky had interviewed Bon Scott in Orlando in 79. So Neil had an old audio clip of Bon that he'd never played, and he said, you know, you can have this. And I ended up, you know, putting it up on YouTube and using it in the book. And so then he introduced me to Michael, and Michael introduced me to Holly. And then suddenly this whole fucking vista just sort of opened up in my research. So I was in New York and went down to Miami, stayed with Holly, hung out with, you know, Neil, and Michael, and literally we got in a car and we drove around Miami one day, just visiting all the places that AC/DC had hung out in 1979 as they were rehearsing Highway to Hell. So we went out to the old rehearsal studios, we went to the hotel where they stayed. You know, we were like, this is an amazing sort of tour in the car, you know, around Miami. We went to this old club called Tight Squeeze, which had been demolished at the time, which was the place that you mentioned where, you know, Bon just walked in and, you know, took a piss in the toilet and sort of said something to the guy next to him. And then suddenly they're hanging out together and, you know, it turns into, you know, sort of 6 weeks together. So all these guys were really very friendly to me. They kind of opened up, they introduced me to other people, and suddenly I had this huge sort of panorama of kind of what had happened in 79 as AC/DC was putting together Highway to Hell. And of course that was very interesting because suddenly some of the lyrics on Back in Black
made sense. Like there was a backstory to You Shook Me All Night Long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll get to that, but I just wanted to comment. It's sort of like you're going through heavy metal forensics. It's like you said, one, all you had to do was get started. So you meet Michael, he introduces you to Holly. Holly's like, well, you got to meet so-and-so, and then you meet so-and-so. Yeah. And then what about some of the management, David Krebs and, the guys within AC/DC, the tour manager, Doug Thayer. How did you get in touch with these guys?
As you say, like when you get onto one person and then you gain that person's trust, they will refer you to someone else. You know, they will send a message to someone else and say, you know what, you should talk to this guy. And then so if you can get that sort of first piece out of the way, you know, the rest usually follow. But it's a dogged tale of persistence, perseverance, and investigation. And that's why it takes so long. You know, this book might be 500 pages, but, you know, I can guarantee you that, you know, 5 million sort of pages of research went into it.
Yeah.
You know, like, but there was a guy called Phil Carson, for instance, who was the president of Atlantic Records in UK in the 70s, who signed AC/DC. So he met me in New York at a bar. He was very helpful to me, you know, in terms of, you know, the sort of business story of AC/DC. But he introduced me to Mick Jones from Foreigner, and suddenly the next day I find myself in Mick Jones's house in New York talking to the, you know, the guitarist of Foreigner in his bathrobe. I mean, this is how it happens. So you just never know where you're going to end up, but it's a case of, you know, just do one piece at a time and give yourself plenty of time to do it, and eventually you will complete it.
Jesse, you're not the first journalist or writer to do this. How did you gain the trust and the access to, you know, a Mick Jones, or, you know, you shared in the book, like you've contacted Pete Way and Chapman before, Paul Chapman. What gave you the street credit? No disrespect, but how did you get that in when others probably have tried and didn't get that access?
The first book really helped the Youngs. And when I wrote the Youngs, I was a nobody. No one fucking knew me.
Okay.
Right. So there is some advantage to that, though, because you're not beholden to sort of old boy networks and all that. And I think a big problem of the rock media is that there are so many people working in that space who just don't want to upset anyone, you know, or they want access or whatever. So they'll get Gene Simmons on their radio show next year or whatever. So never ask Gene Simmons, you know, a curly question. And so they sort of censor themselves. And so I never had that problem because I didn't care whether someone didn't want to talk to me after they'd talked to me. So I would ask them whatever the relevant question was, because, you know, my access to them is not an issue. So there is some advantage to that. But I think, you know, it really just sort of comes down to perseverance and persistence and sort of, you know, not taking no for an answer. And so, you know, there were, you know, you mentioned Pete Way and Paul Chapman. You know, in terms of the story of, you know, Bond's last 24 hours, they were absolutely critical. So, you know, I did whatever whatever I had to do to get to those people.
1979, they're touring America for Highway to Hell. Were they headlining by then or smaller venues?
When they first started in Texas, no, they were the support act of Moxie. So that that was their first show in Austin, but certainly by the end of 79, they were, you know, headlining. But, you know, a lot of that time, particularly after they joined the management company, Lieber Krebs, they were doing a lot of arena shows. They were, you know, doing support for Aerosmith, Ted Nugent, you know, Journey, whatever. But in terms of smaller venues, yes, they were headlining some shows.
So it's 79. They're touring America. They spent a lot of time in Florida. Always going back to Florida. They're in Rochester, Buffalo, everywhere and anywhere. In this book, the detail about they would play and Bond would go out on his own, not really hang out with the band. You know, they really weren't a band of brothers like that. And why is that? Just because he was older or because he was drinking a lot? He was never passed up a drug to try.
He was doing a lot of Quaaludes and cocaine and, you know, drinking everything, you know. But he, in terms of his personality, I think he, you know, he got up there. He had a job to do. He was pretty reliable in that department. I actually only sort of really came across one show. I think it was in Rhode Island where he basically let the band down by being so drunk when he got on stage. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, he was very professional about, you know, his job. But once the job was over, he would go off and do his own thing. As Pete Way said, he had a woman in every court, and that's what he would do, you know. So I think that was his interest. He wasn't interested in hanging out with the other guys in the band at all. He was much older. You know, the amazing thing is, you know, Bond was only 33 when he died, but he looked 53.
He's only 33?
He was 33 years old. It's ridiculous.
The other night I went down in a YouTube rabbit hole. I was watching AC/DC videos. I'm telling you, Jesse, I've been listening to this book since we connected. I actually had the book. I listened to it once like a year ago. And then we connected, so I went back to listening again, and I'm driving around, I'm listening in my car, I'm re-listening to chapters. Something would be mentioned about a show or something. I would go on YouTube and try to see if there's any footage of it, and there was times there was. So I'm doing like a lot of research, and you know, I felt like I was going through heavy metal forensics. So
yeah.
It's just fascinating. So let's talk about the events that lead up to that February night that he died and the speculation that you have about the drug use, how he really died, the deterioration of Bon Scott. You could look at pictures and just see him breaking down.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a big noticeable difference between, you know, the Bon Scott of 1978 and the Bon Scott at the end of 79. Physically, they're two different people, you know, and it's quite heartbreaking actually to sort of see some of the last photos of Bond, because he just looks completely wasted. You know, that sort of week in February 1980 where he dies and all the, you know, the events leading up to that, you know, that was certainly fascinating to me as a writer, because I approached it like essentially a private investigation. And the difficulty obviously was that it happened 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And a lot of the people who are involved in Bond's 24 hours, don't want to talk, or they're dead. You know, 80% of them were heroin addicts. So it was incredibly difficult, and that's why it ended up sort of taking a year and a half to kind of put it together. But there was a statement by Alastair Kinnear that I think he'd made in about 2005, where he sort of went through what happened that night. So that was, you know, the bare bones for me. It was like my template of investigating those final 24 hours. So I would take what Alastair said, and then I would go and compare it to what other people who were there had said. And then suddenly there were many inconsistencies. There were many sort of contradictions. And my job as an investigator obviously was to
to go through each of those sort of inconsistencies and contradictions and sort of come up with the most plausible explanation for what actually happened. I mean, I know this to the listener, this must sound incredibly dense. And it is. It was very, very difficult to follow. But I really believe that kind of what I put down is the most sort of logical explanation for what happened that night.
What kind of history of heroin use did he have that you base this on? Why would you think he's doing heroin that night?
Well, I mean, Bon had a documented heroin overdose in 1975. I mean, that's established. In fact, the Rosie of Whole Lotta Rosie was a sex worker in Melbourne who was a heroin user herself. So, and then in Michael Browning's autobiography, Michael Browning was the manager of AC/DC. He spoke of a second heroin overdose that Bon had in, I think it was in Paris, London. And weirdly, so the Browning has sort of backtracked on that and said, that didn't happen, but it was in his book. And then, my contention was that basically he had a third heroin overdose in London in 1980, and it was fatal this time. Mm-hmm. But there were definitely people who I came across during my research who spoke of Bond's connection to heroin, and certainly like Silver Smith, who was his ex-girlfriend, who was a heroin user herself, she would say, look, Bond's poison of choice was alcohol. But would I say that he never touched heroin? No, I would say that he never touched heroin, but I can't be 100% sure. And he might have done this. And certainly when this person was in town, Bond might have dabbled or whatever. So, she was always kind of leaving open the door in some respect to the possibility of Bond having done that. So it wasn't like 100% categorical, no, Bond never did heroin. Mm-hmm. And certainly when, I get to the final 24 hours of his life and all the people who were surrounding him at that point, they were all heroin users, and Paul Chapman himself said that basically he had given money to Bon Scott to go off and buy heroin and bring it back to his flat. Chapman and Way also told me about another member of AC/DC who was using heroin at that time. So it was a common drug in rock circles.
I laughed out loud in the audiobook when the voiceover guy told the story, like mimicking Bond, about whenever someone would give him something and he would say, I'll take a crack at that. Meaning, I'll give it a shot. If someone offered him something, he wouldn't pass anything up. Was he shooting up? Was he snorting it?
I believe the first one was he was shooting up. But the one in 1980 was a case of him snorting heroin. So snorting brown heroin, which is apparently what everyone in London at that time was doing. It's very difficult for me to kind of condense all this into a. A soundbite for a radio interview.
I agree. Listeners, it's the book is huge. It's great. You get out there, you'll hear all the details. What I'm really getting at is it's just, Bonnie's out partying, just bad decisions when you're hammered. And it's just, it's a roulette. It's just roulette. There's stories in the book of him going out, falling asleep in unlocked cars.
Yeah.
I it's just bad decisions when you just drink daily for months.
But he wasn't really getting the help that obviously he needed. You know, and some people have said, you know, I think, you know, management of AC/DC should take some responsibility for that. And, you know, that's certainly a case can be made for that. I think maybe, you know, the other members of the band could have done more. But, you know, at the end of the day, as I say in the book, you know, Bon was his own man. He made his own choices. He made his own bed. You know, this was the lifestyle that he wanted for himself, and no one was going to stop him. So, you know, he's responsible for his own death, you know. He's responsible for the fact that he took that drug that night that sort of ended his life, and no one else is to blame. But, you know, there's certainly this tendency, I think, of some AC/DC fans to infantilize Bond, you know, to say that, you know, all these other people who are with him, they're the ones who were to blame for, you know, Bond dying. You know, he should have been taken care of. He should have been this, he should have been that. No, at the end of the day, he was an adult, you know, and he fucked up his own life. You know, it doesn't take away from the fact that, you know, I still admire him and I have a lot of love for him. You have to have love for him to spend 4 years of your life writing about someone. You've got to have some love for them. But at the end of the day, he's responsible for what happened.
Was there an autopsy?
Yes, there was an autopsy, but as I present in the book, you know, it was a fairly straightforward, perfunctory, routine autopsy that was sort of handled and sort of conducted, you know, within the space of, you know, from you know, his body landing in the hospital to, you know, the coroner sort of issuing their finding. It was all sort of done and dusted within the space of 72 hours. And I think there was a lot more to it. The fact that, you know, for instance, I can turn up an eyewitness, you know, who was there, who said that she thought that Bond took heroin, to someone else, you know, who said that she was actually in the car with Bond and Alastair Kinnear going back to Alastair's flat. It's like, hang on, there's another person involved in all this? What the fuck were the police doing? This has never come out in any police investigation. Mm-hmm. That these people were. So if I can do it 40 years later, you know, from my laptop in fucking Bali or wherever, you know,
yeah, like, I know.
There is a serious fucking problem with the initial investigation into Bond's death, right? So, like for instance, there's a fake address on the death certificate. How the fuck did that happen? You know, do people look at these details? This is what I'm talking about. I'm actually kind of doing what I believe the detective should have done 40 years ago.
Yeah, you're saying where there's smoke, there's fire. It's like, what the hell's going on here? And so this book comes out. What about national media? You know, no one reached out to you? You know, you have this worm in the water. Rolling Stone, anyone get back to you?
In terms of, you know, big American media outlets, no, it's, you know, fuck Rolling Stone. No, they do fuck all. In that regard, the book, you know, funnily enough, has actually outsold the Youngs. It's definitely the most successful AC/DC book ever. But in terms of, you know, like, you know, mainstream press coverage of the book, most of it has sort of been in Europe or South America or Australia. It's not so much in the United States, apart from, you know, me doing podcasts and small little, you know, shows and things like that. And it really kind of pisses me off. And, you know, like, I feel like saying to Eddie Trunk, you know, fuck you, Eddie.
Well, yeah, and, you know? Excuse me. That's exactly it. It's because we don't give a fuck. I give a fuck about this story. I'm not, you know, it's this, maybe this little grassroots. Every, you know, Metal Mayhem ROC that starts doing this, it gets out there. Maybe because Brian Johnson has acknowledged the Australian writer in that Rolling Stone interview. But you are getting some traction, not enough.
Yeah, you know, I'm just sort of sick and tired of, you know, people like Eddie Trunk, who, you know, you know, will get AC/DC on or whatever, and it's just like a fucking blowjob, you know? It's like, be a fucking journalist. Ask the questions that kind of people are interested in hearing answers to, and they're not being asked, right? So, the Michael Christopher, the rock writer, he asked a few questions of Brian Johnson recently about the whole lyrics issue. Now to me, you know, Brian Johnson is highly unconvincing. I think the fact that he addressed this whole story in his book and did so, I think, in the space of a paragraph, you know, is very telling. No one has really kind of, you know, put the hard questions to him or Angus Young about, you know, why there are so many contradictions in the story, you know, over the years about, you know, how these lyrics came about. And it's about time, you know, people with platform in the United States really looked at this story, because it's really, when you look at it, it's like, you know, this is one of the most significant music stories of all time. We are talking about the biggest selling hard rock album of all time, if not, you know, one of the biggest selling five albums of all time, right? That involves hundreds of millions of dollars. That Brian Johnson's entire career was made off the back of this album. And the man, you know, that I wrote about, Bon Scott, ended up with $30,000 in the bank account. It's a fucking tragedy. So, you know, my message to Eddie Trunk is, you know, fucking pull your finger out and do your job as a journalist.
Yeah, it's the writing's on the wall. I'm going to let you share some of the details that lead you to believe that some of this Back in Black was from Bon, because I'm convinced of it. I don't want to give all the chestnuts away, but let's hear some examples why you think the proof is there that Bon had his fingerprint on Back in Black.
Oh, well, look, the number one thing I think, and look, there are so many details in this book that I couldn't adequately cover them all in the space of one answer. But the thing is that if you look at the history of Bon Scott's lyric writing, he was always writing from his own life experience. And that is why the songs that he wrote during that period, they still resonate with people, because there's usually a story behind them. You know, like a shot down in flames, or, you know, it's a tale of Bond's life.
Down Payment Blues,
Whole Lot of Rosie, Down Payment Blues. You know, all these great songs, right? So you feel like some sort of personal connection to Bon Scott, and then suddenly, you know, you have a song like, you know, You Shook Me All Night Long on Back in Black, which, I mean, I don't care who you are, but if you're listening to that song, you need to acknowledge the fact that that is a very Bon Scott sounding kind of lyric.
Yep.
In that song, and that style of writing, which apparently sort of Brian Johnson sort of came up, you know, off the bat, you know, without having any experience in lyric writing, was never able to reproduce after that album. So, you know, Brian Johnson does sort of interviews, you know, now 42 years later, talking about, you know, his creative peak, which was 1980, which was his first album, with no experience whatsoever in lyric writing, and then he was never able to do it again. And I just don't believe it.
Nope.
Right. So when I go down to Miami and I'm hanging out with Holly Yates, who was a beautiful woman even today in her 60s.
you know, and she shows me photographs of her when she was 19, 20, hanging out with, you know, Bon Scott in Miami. And I see, you know, her in a bikini, and I'm looking at American thighs, and she tells me the backstory to, you know, the lyric, you know, Chartreuse Eyes, which gets changed to Sightless Eyes. And she had a horse called Double Time. And, you know, Bond's love of clean vaginas, you know, she kept her motor clean, all this sort of stuff. I mean, it all fucking makes sense.
It's Bondisms. Right? Bondisms.
Bondisms all over, right?
Yeah.
So, it's, you have to understand, you know, like I'm down there in Miami and I'm meeting someone that I feel like suddenly all the fucking dots have suddenly joined together and I can actually understand the lyrics. So then when I hear, you know, Brian Johnson talking about, oh, you know, I turned up in the Bahamas and I saw a woman on television and she had amazing American thighs and, you know, I used to work with cars and that's why, you know, I had the line, you know, she kept her motor clean and all. It doesn't convince me at all.
No, not at all.
Not at all. And it just seems like the stories keep on changing all the time. And if you go back and sort of listen to all the things that have sort of been said about the lyrics for that song, they're never consistent. And at the end of the day, if you can then go and sort of write a song as good as You Shook Me All Night Long in the space of, what, 15 minutes, which is one of the most perfect sort of pop rock songs of all time, why can't you do it again? You know, Bon Scott could do it consistently, album after album after album after album, right? Why can't Brian Johnson? If he's that cool, let's do it. Let's do it, Brian. Let's see you do it again.
Well, the thing with Brian Johnson, even when he was with Jordy, what is he, have 4 to 5 credited songs that he wrote? But this is the real kicker. Bon Scott passes away on February 19th in 1980, and on July 25th, Back in Black is released. Okay? That's a little over 150 days. So you're telling me that this guy, who was out of music, gets the gig, they get together, they write music, he's never really wrote lyrics, they record, and the album's mastered and released, and it's one of the best, you know, highest selling, most fantastic albums of all time?
Yeah, exactly. And there's a guy on Bon Scott Forum called Larry Black, and he said, you know, the other thing is, you know, why would the entire, you know, sort of AC/DC machine, the apparatus, management, crew, everyone fly out to the Bahamas with all their equipment, you know, book studios, book Mutt Lang, everything else, and not know whether their lead singer could actually write songs?
Yeah.
Right? So, they get to the Bahamas and suddenly, you know, Malcolm Young is turning to Brian Johnson saying, oh, by the way, you know, can you write lyrics? And it's like, no, no fucking way. That's not going to happen, right? They went out to the Bahamas because they had songs to record. They didn't turn up without songs.
I think somewhere down the line that they told a lie and then they had to stay with it all this time. It would have been easier right from the beginning. It's like, look at all, we were able to, you know, bonnet some leftover stuff. Brian's going to do some of it. And the last question I have on all of this is the mention of the Scott family receiving a royalty check, some royalty checks from Back in Black. And why was Back in Black included in that Bonfire box set?
Yeah. So Vince Lovegrove was a bandmate of Bond's in a band called The Valentines. This was obviously before AC/DC. It was a bubblegum pop band from Western Australia. And Vince was convinced that basically Bond's lyrics had been used on Back in Black. And he sort of started a new career as a journalist. Managed to speak to the Scott family for a story back in, I think it was 2005. And he said in that story that he had been told by Derek Scott, the brother of Bon Scott, that the family received royalties for Back in Black. And he put this in print. He put this in his story in the West Australian newspaper. And Vince also kind of wrote about this issue on his personal blog in around, I think it was 2011. And he died in 2012 from memory, in a car accident. But, so what he managed to sort of put down was very valuable in that it was a sort of a, the verbal testimony of someone who was very close to Bob Scott, who also had a connection to the Scott family, saying that this actually happened. So in terms of me actually being able to access things like, bank statements or whatever, no. That's never going to happen. But what's interesting is that, there are certain powers that be that in the Bon Scott world who are obviously very pissed off about the book that I've written. They're very pissed off that I have had the success that I've had with the book in terms of, telling the true story of how he lived, the connection to heroin and so on. So there was a move in recent times to kind of, I think, reclaim some of that territory. So, you'll find that the Bon Scott estate, they've got their own website now. They're releasing sort of officially licensed sort of Bon Scott memorabilia and products through their website. There's a Bon Scott bloody action figure now, All this sort of stuff. But they've also got their own website, and then on that website, they've sort of said, that the Bon Scott estate doesn't, receive royalties for any songs on Back in Black. But what does that mean? Does that mean that they don't get a check at all? What does that mean? So there are a lot of sort of inconsistencies and questions that, still unanswered about that whole thing. And then the fact is, at the end of the day, I was the only journalist in the history of the world that went to the trouble of actually finding out how much money was actually in Bond's bank account when he died. And there was absolutely fuck all. So I just think it's a tragedy, really.
Well, it's a fantastic piece of work, Jesse. The book, Bond, The Last Highway, get over to jessefinksbooks.com. Buy it from there. Follow Jesse at Jesse Fink on Twitter. And like you mentioned, there's Facebook, Bond Scott locations. And Jesse, I'm going to do my damnedest, with my audience. And, we're going to call up Eddie Trunk. We're going to wait on hold. At the very least, we say, hey, let's get the Jesse Fink, the Bond, okay. We'll put that on there. We'll get you. We'll do our share here. It's a great book. So again, Jesse Fink has a new book coming out in 2023. Any tease? It's not a rock book. What's this one coming out?
It's a biography of a man called Charles Howard Dick Ellis, who was an Australian-born British intelligence officer for MI6, who actually came out to the United States in 1940 and set up OSS, what became the CIA. And he was accused of being a Nazi and Soviet spy, so a double agent for enemy powers. And he died in 1975, and it's a sort of a, like Bon Scott, it's sort of like a cold case investigation of, the case against Dick Ellis, whether he was actually a traitor of epic proportions or whether he was actually innocent. So that's sort of taken 2 years of my life as well.
Well, good. And this Pure Narco looks interesting. The life story of Luis Navia. So
So that came out of Bob Scott in that, you know, a friend in Miami had sort of put me onto a big-time cocaine trafficker from the 1980s who, you know, wanted to write his life story. And I ended up spending 3 years, you know, working on that. And we've kind of, we sold an option to that recently. So hopefully that gets made into a TV series soon.
Oh, good. Then, you know, I would say then you get really rich and you move to some island in like Bali, but you're already there. So let's fill the bank account. Jesse, thanks for spending your morning with us. I appreciate it. And, you know, good luck, man. We'll follow you on Facebook and check it out and do our best up here at Metal Mayhem to spread the truth and all your work, friend.
Thanks very much, mate. And if anyone's, you know, interested in hearing more about Bon on Facebook, join Bon Scott Forum.
We'll have all this on the show notes and all on our website and everything. So
everyone, thanks a lot, dude.
All right, bro. Have a good one. And, you know, ride on, like Bon says, ride on.
Okay.
See you, man.
Thanks. Bye. Oh, bye.
Metal for Life.
Thank you for listening to Metal Mayhem ROC. Check out our website at metalmayhemroc.com for information on podcasts, archives, links to all our live radio shows, and all sorts of info. Please like, follow, and share with everyone, even your non-metal friends. And always remember to keep it heavy.